hell that I was in, I'd do anything to be better.
I thought like a lunatic.
You kind of just have like that little bit of hope that it will get better.
You're gonna make it.
This began my surrender.
I am a witness of my own growth.
It's a life beyond your wildest dreams, and I just have to say, it works if you work it.
My story, that's what I share.
You're listening to Far From Finished, a weekly podcast where we share new, real-life stories of hope and triumph, told by the people who live them. Today's story comes to us from...
My name is Michelle, and my sobriety date is 11/24/2015. I grew up in the beautiful Pacific Northwest with my two parents and my two sisters, and we had a very, I would say, good life. My father was a doctor, a DO, of a doctor of osteopath, and my mom was a homemaker. And so we had a pretty traditional Catholic upbringing. Went to public school and did really well in school. Never had any problems. Did a lot of participation in sports and music and arts, and just kind of lived that childhood dream. Never struggled for anything in life. I wouldn't say I ever had everything handed to me. I worked really hard in school and during those sports. And so I learned a lot just about work ethic and how important education is and how important family is. And, you know, growing up in the church, having our responsibilities and following our sacraments within the church was important. And so until about the third grade, did I experience my first kind of, I would say, natural traumatic event in my family. My parents decided to split. And the reasonings at the time for why they decided to do that were unknown. And it was a very difficult process for me of breaking up my home. My father was never really home growing up much because he was working so much. He had multiple private practices and would do his rounds in the hospitals over the weekend. And so I never really had a lot of time to be around him. And the time that we did share was very valuable. And I idolized him. I looked up to him. I wanted to marry somebody like him. Something that's a traditional relationship that a daughter would have with their father. And so when it was time for my parents to split, I stayed and my sister stayed with my mom. And that energy, that confusion, that heartache, that grief of our family breaking up, all of that I channeled to my mother, blaming her for the relationship ending. And so we kind of tried to carry on our lives the best way we could. My father gave the rights to my mom, and we would see him when we were able to see him. And my mother had never drank alcohol, done any drugs in her entire life. So the only time before my parents split that alcohol was even really introduced or around was a few times I would remember my dad would come home late at night and be extremely intoxicated. And at the time, I didn't really know what was wrong with him. I just knew he was acting different and had been in fights. And so that was pretty much the only glimpse of I saw him that I knew something was off. And I would always idolize him, but I would be pulled back by, that's not my dad. What is he doing? What's going on? So I had a lot of confusion around that. So when I could get with him on the weekends, I would spend all of my time with him. We would fish, we would hunt, we would go boating, we would just, you know, go outside. He lived on a cabin on a river, and we would just spend a lot of time outdoors just talking about life, education, relationships, all of that. And we kind of continued that lifestyle. And I knew that, you know, alcoholism had been brought up once in one of our conversations about the fact that his family struggled. And when you're younger, you don't realize that you're predisposed to this genetic component of alcoholism. You just had been told that this runs in our family and is something I should stay away from. Typically, it's going to go in one ear and out the other. And so we had had that conversation, and by the time I turned 15, I had received a phone call that my father had passed away. And he had passed away from a massive heart attack while at work. And so the person that you idolize, the person that is on this pedestal that can do no wrong, is now no longer here. So having that loss was very difficult. Went through bereavement counseling, went through, you know, the typical, you know, counseling that had reminded me of the divorce counseling that we had to do. And it was okay. But, you know, when you're 15 years old, you don't know how to process grief and emotion and don't know what to do. I can't say that my studies went downhill by any means. I had never experienced with drugs and alcohol, had never been sexually active, and just really tried to work through the loss the best way I could. As people in our lives get older, they leave, and it just perpetuated this vicious cycle of major life events. My husband, or my uncle, he became paraplegic. My grandparents died. My mother was diagnosed with a severe illness, and it just became this snowball effect of the new norm is just don't get close to people because people leave you. And then there's that sense of abandonment, that sense of disconnection, that sense of they didn't love me because they made poor choices, they didn't take care of their health, they didn't want to stick around and be a part of my life. And so all these things kept going through my head. So I continued on, graduated with honors in high school, actually almost graduated a year early because I really just buckled down and buried myself in sports and books. And at that time, I met my current husband. Met him and we went to high school together. He was a year older than me and captained the football team, wrestling team, baseball team. And there's this guy that's interested in me. And I haven't had any attention or affection or been noticed by any other male figure, nor did I ever try to seek that out. And I met him. He went on to college. We continued our relationship. I graduated as early as I could because he was a year ahead of me. And we ended up going to college together. He ended up not sticking with it, chose a career in baseball. And I finished out college within the 4 years at a local university. And we did a great job of just really surviving that college lifestyle. That would be my first experience, I would have to say, of experimenting with alcohol. It became like the, you know, the local parties and things that you would normally do. I could take it, I could leave it, I could have a few, I could decline it. It never had an effect on me where I felt I was dependent or obsessed or craved or it ever affected my work or my studies. And so went through that whole period of college, never experimenting with any other drugs. It was just, again, a more of a social thing to be consuming the alcohol. And I graduated from college, did great, and went on into the workforce. And did great working in the criminal justice field and really trying to be that advocate for women survivors of domestic violence and people struggling with addiction and people diagnosed with mental illness. And so did a lot of work out in the community and just tried to educate myself. And my husband and I got married and we got married and eloped in Hawaii after 8 years of dating, which was just fantastic. I felt like we had traveled, we had graduated from college. We kind of had our stuff together. We were ready to get a home and we were ready to buckle down and just be adults. And so we decided to go to Hawaii and we got married and we got back to the Pacific Northwest, and about a few weeks later, my husband had decided to enlist in the military. And once he decided to do that, he was immediately activated to deployment. And so this was a breaking point for me in the sense of the man that I love, the man who says he'll never leave me, is going overseas and he may not come home. And so for me, looking back and not in that moment, didn't realize how significant of a decision he made for the both of us. I didn't want to lose him, but I didn't want to be his mom. I didn't want to tell him what he can and can't do. And the decision and the outlook he had was bettering a future for us. So he left. And we stayed in touch and, you know, it was only supposed to be a few weeks. And that's the first time looking back, I remember finding alcohol as a way to suppress my emotions of grief, abandonment, disappointment, heartache. And that went on for a few months. He ended up getting injured and coming home, which was the best thing that could have happened. And so that was my first glimpse at utilizing that particular substance as a way to cope with life when I wasn't liking what I was experiencing. And so instead of pulling back and saying, hey, what is going on? What do I have control over? What don't I have control over? I chose to just numb those particular feelings because those were bringing up other horrible life events. And so one thing I've learned through the process is where there is intensity, there is history. And so rolling the tape forward, he came home and didn't really struggle with the reconnection since, of course, we had just been married and things went back to normal. He ended up getting a job and we both were just, you know, really working head on trying to get our careers underway. And then we decided a few years later that we wanted to start a family. And so we made those first moves and decided of, you know, kind of the timing, you know, what was important to us, you know, what our core values are and how this is going to work growing a family. And so a few years later, we had our daughter and she was the best thing that ever happened to us. And everything was great. I ended up just financially having to work two jobs because my husband had been laid off and had gotten a new job. And so I was working a couple of jobs in a local prison, which was very difficult to do while you're having a newborn and you're trying to balance and all of your time is spent in a correctional setting. It gets extremely difficult to be able to decompress and come home before you do it again. However, I had to do what I had to do. And so that continued for quite a while. We decided to get pregnant with our second one. And I did the same thing. And so you can imagine how worn out I became of then working two jobs, having two small kids, my husband finally landing his dream job, which he absolutely loves. And he was on the road a lot. He traveled a lot. He worked a lot of overnight shifts, but I wanted to support him because I had found a career that I was extremely passionate about. And I wanted that for him. And that was a total eye-opening experience for me because looking back at my childhood, I would try to like make people happy and please people so that it brought me joy knowing that other people were experiencing joy and happiness. That just makes me happy. I love to help and to inspire and to motivate other people into pursuing their dreams and getting the results that they want. And so he spent a lot of time on the road. And so I would spend a lot of lonely, disconnected evenings around the clock by myself. And I had lacked that disconnect with my friends and family that I used to have because I had more time on my hands. I had the ability to and the flexibility to get up and do things. And so what I noticed is when I was able to get out, everything with motherhood is associated, or a lot of it is associated with alcohol. You go to a painting party, you go to a yoga party, you go to a concert, go to happy hour, everything, every social event and everyone that I hung out with, the common denominator was alcohol. And at first I'd walk into Target and say, oh, look at that shirt, isn't it cute or funny? And it just became my world in order to be prepared for the shift with my kids alone. I felt like I deserved a reward, like I was some type of dog that deserved a reward because I was prepping myself for what I already knew I was going to be experiencing. Or I would drop off the kids with the grandparents and allow myself to go give myself a treat and reward myself. And alcohol at that point, it was always fun until it wasn't fun anymore. Until I was utilizing that substance and consuming that drug as a way to manage life on life terms was the first eye-opening experience I had to to say, wow, Michelle, let's pull back the lens. Why are you feeling like you cannot manage the day the way it is right now? And that was my first glimpse at figuring out, how am I going to be able to heal myself out loud? How am I can't be the only one experiencing what I'm experiencing. But I wasn't there yet. I felt that I was super mom and everybody counted on me, and I was the volunteer coordinator and I was working and I was doing so much for everyone else that I didn't want to show myself as being weak. I didn't want to be judged. I didn't want to follow against the grid. And so I really felt trapped. I tried to give it up. I tried to decline happy hours. And I could keep myself sober for a period of time. And I considered myself more of a binge drinker, which I think is even more dangerous than a regular alcoholic. And I really didn't have the leadership, the connection, the education to say, hey, what is this that's going on with me? Am I just doing this because I'm just miserable and unhappy? And so I had to do a lot of soul searching, but the time that I had that was allowed was minimal. Being a mom, trying to figure everything out. And so I let the best get to me, and I just completely got entrenched with drinking. I was struggling so hard with the postpartum depression and trying to balance all this that there was no time for me to try to figure out anything. Or looking back, I didn't take those necessary steps of self-care. And you don't feel like you have them when you're completely depressed and sleep deprived. Because if you don't fill up your tank of self-care and do something nice for yourself, you can't be there for the people that you love. And at that point, it wasn't about me. It was about survival of my kids. I would wait until they went to sleep, and I would drink and I would drink and I would drink until I would pass out. I was too fearful to go and ask for behavioral health treatment with my depression, thinking they're going to tag my chart. They're not going to want me to have my kids. I completely just catastrophized this whole idea of it's okay to ask for help. It actually means that you're strong by stepping out of your darkness, owning your truth and speaking it. And it took me a long time of doing that. I continued on this path of 2 to 3 week binges. They were awful. I wouldn't remember anything. I would have to scroll through my phone in the morning to see what I did, who I talked to. I would wake up in the middle of the night looking for my stashes because I always had to have something. It became this dependency physically where I hated it, but I needed it. And my husband couldn't trust me. He would get calls at work. He didn't want to leave his kids home with me. He did not know where the woman that he married and met in high school went. He knew that I was invincible. I could balance it all. And everybody was just so amazed by the ability that I had to do it when inside I was breaking down, trying to balance everything and all the expectations that everyone had on me. And I realized I created those own expectations on myself. And so going into a couple of years having and balancing both kids, I had overdrank, and I had the ambulance somehow pick me up, take me to the hospital, and I had a 0.43 blood alcohol level. And I woke up and had a Child Protective Services worker looking over me. And at that moment, my heart dropped. I am Mama Bear. No one messes with my kids. I love my kids, but apparently I love to drink more. And that was my first rude awakening saying, Michelle, you have a problem. This is not something you can do on yourself. It's bigger than you. And so after I was discharged from the hospital, of course, I'm having the involvement of CPS, pretty much not playing that big of a role in my life besides just the random UAs. And I had decided that I need to get away. I need to work on me so that I can be there for the people that I love. And so I talked it over with my husband, and never doing any type of behavioral health treatment or mental health treatment, we just kind of decided to go against, you know, the whole process of levels of treatment and say, I need the inpatient. I don't want to be assessed for anything other than the inpatient. I want to get away. I need to learn how to do all of this and still love my children and love me. And so I decided to go to a women's only inpatient treatment. And the contract was created, the treatment plan was created for a 30-day stint. I got there and I really struggled with finding the similarities, not the differences in the women that were there. And so just being an alcoholic, not to make that sound like it's not just as important and deadly as the rest of the drugs out there, but it was extremely hard for me, or I was extremely being stubborn of not opening up my mind and the idea of the possibilities of how similar our stories are versus how different they are. And I felt very disconnected from the group of women that were there. And so I really tried to create as much structure as I could, you know, pull the cotton out of my ears and just be present there. And I stayed there for 21 days and got pulled into one of the counselor's office and was told that my time was going to be extended. And at that time, I became very frustrated, very entitled, and decided that I wanted to leave. I had agreed to 30 days and no one had mentioned any of this in any of our sessions. And we were wrapping up, getting ready to end treatment. And the long and the short of it is my husband came and ended up picking me up and I stayed sober for quite some time. I cannot remember the exact moment of why I decided to relapse, but I did. And CPS became in my life one more time. And at that time, I had to figure it out. I cannot have them coming in and out of my life. I had these children because I wanted to be a mother. And at that time, all I wanted to do was numb the ability and the fact that I had this responsibility. And to managing it seemed completely impossible. And so I started going to local AA groups. Of course, walking in, no sobriety time, shaking completely, shame covered all over my face. And I just felt that recovery was so far out of reach that the disease continued to keep telling me that I could do this on my own. I could do this in moderation. I've done this before. I'm not a true alcoholic. I'm a binge drinker. If I can just get past a couple of weekends, then I can do it. And I kind of went in and out of those rooms for probably another 6 months before, you know, they say sometimes you hit rock bottom. I think you don't have to hit a bottom. I think for me, I woke up one morning on the 24th of November, 2015 and said, you know what? I completely surrender. I am an alcoholic. I cannot do this on my own and I am scared to death. And looking back, I had so many warning signs of, I got so caught up into the shame. Who's going to know? Who's going to judge me? I can do this in moderation. No one will know because I only do it when my kids are sleeping. And all of that was a complete lie of my addiction. So I kept going. I decided that I am just, instead of doing this whole notion of let's count days, all I wanted to do was just that quote that they use in AA, just for today, I'm going to distract myself. I'm going to give myself the best shot. Today, I'm going to do it for today. And I just kept that mindset of when the urge comes, the urge will go. And that's the beauty of those feelings and emotions, is that they don't last forever. If you cannot engage in that and distract them and lower the intensity by building my own toolbox of tools, that I could get through a couple of hours. I could get through a really awkward social situation. And I just kept treading that water. I did a lot of reflection. I said no a lot. And the reason I did that is because I wanted to be able to say yes next time. And I had people that didn't connect with me, left me out of social situations. And I was angry. I was angry at everybody who could do it, and I couldn't. And the disease kept me in this perpetual cycle of thinking, well, you've done it before, you can get back to where you are. And the truth is, for me, the first drink will get me drunk. I cannot have just one drink. And I explored, I educated myself, I listened to podcasts, I got books, I surfed the web, I did a lot of meditation. Anything that I could do to fuel my mind with self-help and positive affirmations and mindset work. It's about, you know, what do you want? What do you want your life to look like? How do you have the power to say no? Why do you want to say no? And I think my why of being sober and staying sober was bigger than my reason to consume alcohol. For my why, it was why I drank wasn't because I enjoyed the flavor or because I liked hanging out with people, because the majority of the time I drank, I was a closet drunk. I would do it when no one knew, which helped keep me sicker longer, because these secrets keep you sick. People would know I would drink and they didn't think I had a problem, because they didn't see when I would leave happy hour, but I would stop at the store and get two more bottles on my way home. You know, people would at first make excuses for me, and until my excuses became complete lies that nobody else would keep up. They tried to help, but they didn't know how to do it. And I didn't even know how to help myself. I decided to get online too. I was never a big social media person. And so what I did was I started getting onto Instagram and Facebook and starting to follow some of these other women who were advocates of mental health awareness and advocates of addiction and recovery. And I started following them and was completely inspired by their journey. And looking back, I couldn't be that person. And I can stand up for the rights of so many other people for so many different situations. But when it became me, I couldn't do it. And I think it was just too much shame and attention for me to bear. And so I decided to make this decision of, I am going to speak up. I am going to recover out loud, and I'm going to create these pages, because if I'm struggling with this in this mom situation, of there is this secret underlying world of motherhood that's not talked about, that's completely glamorized. And I get the fact that not everyone's an alcoholic, and I encourage everyone to not get wrapped up into that title. I don't care why you want to slow down or test drive sobriety. Just give yourself permission. I don't care if you don't feel like you have a problem. Just see if you can take a break from it. See if that, because stopping alcohol for me, if I would have taken more breaks to see what is really triggering me, really taking inventory of why I felt I needed to consume, you just get so caught up into why you're doing it versus really understanding what's underneath that's triggering it, because that's where the true work happens. And so for me, these groups were extremely powerful. I'm connecting with women all over the world. It is amazing. And the encouraging words, you know, I'm connecting and working with some of these women, creating programs. And it's just such a wonderful thing for these women to step out of their shame and to speak their truth, because our stories are so similar that we don't have to do this alone. It doesn't have to be this big, huge secret. And to be completely honest, when I first started to get sober and doing this on my own, nobody believed I was able to do it. They knew my cycle. They knew it would be every 2 to 3 weeks until I would binge. And I would just have to tell myself, you know, people would think, oh, you're acting weird, you're drinking. They would want to search my stuff. You know, and, you know, up until a couple months ago, I still found bottles throughout my house that I had stashed, you know, and that's an awful, disgusting feeling, but it's not going to give me permission to then give up. And so connecting with these women and just being empowering, it's been the best thing for me. And I just kind of allowed this time to keep ticking. And before I knew it, you know, I had several months, and I had 6 months, and I had 9 months, and I had, oh my God, it's been a year. And people are just like, I knew you could do it. This is amazing. Like, I actually have a problem. Can we talk? And to be able to have that response was completely amazing to me, because before and going through it, it was so hard to find the joy in the journey where people were not including me. And the reasons that they weren't including me weren't necessarily because they don't want to hang out with me now that I don't drink. It's the fact that they may want to drink and don't want to stop out of respect or need to respect. They're not including me because they don't want me to be triggered. There's so many reasons for me to get out of my own head, not be stubborn and selfish, and say that there might be a reason that they're doing this that could be helpful for you. And so anybody struggling with that, I encourage you just to take it moment by moment and really be in tune with, why are you doing this? And I really struggled with the relationships with my sisters. And, you know, I did forget to mention in, you know, when I had both my children, my mom had passed away. And that was just throwing in more fuel for the fire, because again, it's another loss. My mom's supposed to be there when I have kids. She's supposed to be able to be there to share and tell me how to do this when I'm bawling in the middle of the night and can't see straight. And so that was another big piece where I've had to process the grief of that. And so I've had a lot of loss in my life. And, you know, my older and my younger sister are kind of our family. That's what we have that's left. And my younger sister is an alcoholic and has been in recovery for 7 years. And my older sister isn't. And I think that they really struggled with how best to support me, that at the end of this, before I got sober, they pulled away. And that was really hard for me because I felt like I was going to lose my sisters and I was choosing the alcohol over them instead of really processing and going through all of these stages of grief and really coming out on side saying, I'm going to be a stronger person. I'm going to live a life that these people are going to be proud of that are no longer in my life. They don't want me to fall victim to this trap. And so I just utilized that. You know, now that I'm sober, I have the trust back of my husband that took the longest amount of time, and the trust of my sisters. And, you know, my older daughter was there to witness some of this, and she is my strongest supporter, you know. And when we get older, we're going to talk about the effects and the predisposition that she has to alcohol genetically, because I don't want to pretend like this isn't going to happen to her. And just the beauty of recovery, you guys, knowing that you can wake up every single morning and not be sick, not live with regret, not wonder what you did, and find yourself again. Find yourself what you love to do that's fun. You can still do every single thing that you used to do. And guess what? You actually get to remember what you did and have the best time knowing you're not going to get kicked out. No one's going to be mad at you. You didn't spend a ton of money. You're not getting all these extra empty calories. I mean, I could go on and on about the benefits and how much my life has changed. It's back to the way the normal, quote unquote, normal Michelle before she put too much on her plate and crumbled. I completely, slowly, progressively, I slowly over time destructed myself. It was self-destruction, and I did it slowly where it didn't seem as deadly and toxic. And so remember that this making the commitment to live a life of recovery is scary. But you know what's scarier is living a life still stuck in that disease, and that there is help for people, and people do recover and people do change. And I now have the tools to be able to say, I can't go out tonight because I'm not spiritually fit, or I'm going to have to say no. So next time I can say yes. This sounds really fun, but I know that you guys, you know, are more than social drinkers, and I don't feel safe in that situation, you know, and I really just have to really weigh whether or not this is going to be a good fit for me. And so that's how my toolbox is filled, my tank is filled, because I actually wake up before my kids, not to my kids, which has been a huge piece of the puzzle for me, of not allowing my anxiety and my depression, which I now seek a counselor and read personal development and podcasts about. I don't have to be everything to everybody. I can be okay in being me and know that what I've done for today is enough, and that solution is not at the end of that bottle, the bottom of that bottle, because it never will be. It never really was. It's this delusional idea that when you want temporary relief, of being a human being who wants instant gratification, that in that moment, there might be some relief, but long term, the problem's not solved. It's just creating more problems later. And so I will continue to live this life of sobriety. I will speak my truth. No one is ever safe from this disease. And I truly believe that the person with the most sobriety time is the person who woke up first. And I will never stop fighting. I will never stop working on myself. I will fight for my family. I will fight for my kids. I will fight for myself. And I will fight for everybody who struggles with this, because we are only as sick as our secrets. And I will continue to fight until I have no fight left. As I began working on myself and exploring the personal development and the diseases of addiction and reading articles and doing podcasts, I collected all this educational material, all these statistics, all of these hard factual evidence-based practices of people struggling with addiction. And I became so intrigued with knowing that if I struggle with this, other people obviously struggle with this. And so I decided to explore the idea of getting certified to be able to work with women or men in the capacity of really understanding their addiction and working through the stages of change. And so it took me a couple of years to get certified and to complete the credit hours and the classes. And I am now a practicing certified addiction counselor. So I choose to specialize in working with women who have trauma and are struggling with addiction. So I really work with women trying to test drive sobriety, to try and give themselves permission to live a lifestyle that others may not approve of, but to live a life that's test driving sobriety. So let's give it a shot. Let's see what you have to lose and see how your life plans out. See if things in your life become better than they were before. And really just teaching people to love themselves, to shift their mindset into focusing on more of what they want out of life and to really finding that joy in the journey, because that's truly what's important. The words I have for encouragement for women who are struggling with it, it's just a question if you're questioning why or if you're an alcoholic, reach out to somebody, get into one of the private social media platforms, and just try to get in with women that are like-minded to see if you find any connection, you find a story that you can relate to. You can always talk to your doctor, you can talk to your therapist, you can talk to your partner, you can go to an AA meeting. Just start to have conversations and just truly ask yourself, why do I feel like I'm needing to use or consume alcohol to manage a difficult situation for me? And really just do some self-reflection, you know, try to figure out what it is of why I'm having to do that, because there are so many resources out there and there are so many people that are in your spot, and you just need to start by putting it out there. Like I said, our secrets are only as sick as we are.